From Tribune Tower, WGN Radio presents a conversation.
I want to make one thing perfectly clear.
A dialogue.
What are you prepared to do?
An astute debate.
Everything that's in the law.
And a peek behind the curtain of politics.
And then what are you prepared to do?
I think Chicago is not only the center of the country, I think it's the center of the world.
Don't tread on them.
Where did this statement come from?
This is the Sunday Spin. Your host is the Chicago Tribune's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, and welcome to this week's edition of the Sunday Spin for February the 12th, 2017. This is our weekly look into politics and policies in Chicago, Illinois, and Washington, D.C. So it's time once again to grab the Sunday paper, go get that hot cup of coffee, and we'll try to get your day and week off to a good start. Okay, I know I said I wasn't going to watch the Super Bowl last Sunday, but you know what? I did, and it was one of the worst first halves of football I think I've ever seen. But just as I was starting to wind down after a long Sunday, I left the second half on, and then, wow. I mean, what a game. What a game.
I was about ready to text my good friend in Atlanta to congratulate him. But I ended up waiting.
Well, and I think like the first edition of the Boston Globe had Atlanta winning. That was their Dewey defeats Truman headline.
Oh, yeah, I saw that story. And it actually was circulated. It ended up on someone's porch.
Yes. Wow. But what? Oh, I mean, just Sam, that was one of the best football games ever.
Did you really think so? Or was it an ultimate collapse?
Well, both. Both.
I thought it was a sloppy game for three quarters.
Yes.
Really sloppy, but a great finish. I'll say it was a great finish.
Okay.
Meet me in the middle, Rick.
Yeah, no. But the collapse of the Falcons and, you know, and I'm sorry, Tom Brady, you know, just go get it done.
Was there any doubt when they got the ball first in overtime that they were going to score a touchdown?
No.
I knew it was going to happen. I feel like everybody knew that.
Yeah, I think so, too. I think so, too. You also had to know that if Atlanta got the ball, they were probably going to score. I just had that feeling that, you know, this they could still be playing this football game if it wasn't for sudden death, you know. I mean, it was just a fantastic finish. And, you know, if that's going to be the end of football for a while, what a way to end the season. But, you know, we got baseball right around the corner. How about them Blackhawks? 5 in a row and all road wins, which is even more phenomenal. Although I was sorry to see them have to go to overtime against Minnesota and give up that, as people call it, the loser point for going into overtime. So we only netted 1 point out of that. But and then a great win last night against Edmonton. I have to admit, I only made it through the a little bit of the first period before I had to finally go night-night so I could be up this morning with all of you. And then they play today at 5 o'clock?
No, the Hawks off today.
They're off today.
They're off for a whole week.
Why do I have them listed on this schedule?
Got the Bulls playing this afternoon, but the Hawks have a whole week off.
And, you know, I didn't know about that issue of teams getting weeks off.
Must be nice.
Well,
it's a new part of the labor agreement.
Right.
You just get a week off in February.
Hey, well, you know, they've had 5 good games in a row, and now is the time when you want to get everybody all healed up and make it for the home stretch for playoff time. But and you said the Bulls are today?
Yeah, Bulls play Tom Thibodeau and the Timberwolves. That'll be fun.
Well, I'm glad you brought up the Bulls because I had a nice chance this past week to moderate a question and answer session out at Aurora University, my good friends out there, question and answer session on Thursday night for their Town Square series. And, you know, they bring a lot of people out there and talk about issues and ideas, and they had David Axelrod out there. And so my first question to him was, you know, given all of the contention and people talking every day, I said, you know, what the heck is going on with those Chicago Bulls? And David's got to be, I think he's been a season ticket holder for 40 years. And his first response was, David says, get rid of Jimmy Butler, which I thought was got some crowd reaction there. But I can't imagine them without Jimmy Butler.
I can't imagine David Axelrod playing GM. That's pretty outstanding. Wheeling and dealing.
He could probably he can play a role in basketball. There's no doubt about that. In fact, when he came to Chicago, to the University of Chicago for school, that's how he met his wife, was on a co-ed basketball league.
I remember Arne Duncan was a good hooper.
Yes. Hooper?
Yeah, he was a good
hoopster.
Hooper.
Hooper.
You don't say hooper?
No.
Hoopster, baller, hooper?
Hoopster. I've never heard hooper before.
He's a lefty, too, Duncan. He shoots with his left hand.
You played against him?
No, I saw him play a couple times in the All-Star Challenge.
Was he in this previous one?
I don't think he was in this one, but he played a couple years in a row. I think he had like 15 or 20 points.
Wow.
He was the Secretary of Education, and he was out there just lighting it up.
Huh. Well, I know he was part of that, you know, the cadre with him and Alexi Giannoulis and, that guy that used to be in the White House. What was his name? Oh, Barack Obama, I believe. Yeah, they were part of the pickup basketball games. And actually, Alexi's told some great stories about how to drive on to Obama, which is just hilarious. Let's go Bulls. Let's get past the controversies and let's pick it up here a little bit. We want to see the United Center busy for a while.
What are you going to do with the Blackhawks being off all week now?
I know. I'm kind of traumatized. I will tell you, it's about this time of year, though, when I will start looking at the other games and other teams and
evaluating them to see perspective. About how we may do in the playoffs.
Watching film.
Yeah, that's right. Watching the film.
Watching film.
Sure, like in the locker room.
Crank up the projector.
Now, see, Sam has no clue what you're talking about right there. Watching like the Washington Capitals, who are just a tremendous hockey team. So I'll be scoping out the other teams. There's always hockey. I mean, thankfully for that. And we got spring training starting soon. Pitchers and catchers reporting.
When do they start again, Sam? Tuesday?
White Sox report tomorrow. Cubs report on Tuesday.
Yeah.
So, wow.
And it looks like a lot of the work at Wrigley is progressing very well.
I saw that. They've just torn it up completely. They're adding all the club levels now and doing things around the park. And, of course, we'll have the office building will be complete, which is on the corner of Clark and Waveland. I don't know where I'm going to park this year. I believe I'll park in Evanston when I go to the games. The media used to park right next to the stadium, right on Clark Street across from the McDonald's.
Right.
Now we get shuttled in from, I think it's like Irving Park.
Oh, really?
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know where we're going to end up this year. They haven't told us yet.
You're better off on the Red Line, aren't you?
Just park in Waukegan. Take a shuttle.
Well, but. Wow, it's hard to believe baseball in the air. I mean, it just seems like we just got through all the hoopla of the World Series. And, man, the world champion Chicago Cubs. This is just amazing times that we're living in, no doubt about that. Well, Dave's here to keep us up to date on all the news. Sam's getting us up to date on all of the sports. Producer Jasmine is here to field your phone calls. We're at 312-981-7200. That's also our text line, 312-981-7200. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/thesundayspin. We're on Twitter at @SundaySpin. And Engineer Bob is still sorting through the Super Bowl leftovers here in the Allstate Showcase studio. As always, if you have to tune away, you can find our shows on WGNRadio.com, and you can also get our podcasts at iTunes by searching for me, Rick Pearson. Well, up ahead today, after Dave catches us up on the 7:30 news update, we'll be speaking to Elliot Richardson. Elliot is founder and CEO of the Small Business Advocacy Council. We've had Elliot on before to talk about the impact of Illinois' budget stalemate on small businesses, but now they're starting to coalesce and demand some action in Springfield. We'll speak in the 8 o'clock hour to Republican Congressman Peter Roskam from Wheaton. We'll talk about the Republicans' plans to replace Obamacare, change the tax code, and we'll discuss the visible opposition that's surfaced. Dave's got more news at 8:30, and then we'll speak to my good friend Michael Golden. Michael is the author of Unlock Congress, and he was recently named a senior fellow at the Adlai Stevenson Center for Democracy. And we'll talk about a host of issues, both federal and state. That's all coming up, but first we're going to take a quick break. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN. Good Sunday morning. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. This is your Sunday Spin, and it's time for our weekly spin through national politics. And what can I say? Another week filled with news started by, involving, and surrounding President Donald Trump. We have the unanimous ruling by the 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals keeping the stay on the president's travel ban. Now there's talk that the president may issue a new revised executive order. But after the appeals court ruled, the president tweeted, quote, "See you in court," unquote. Well, last night on Saturday Night Live featuring Alec Baldwin, they gave the president his day in court, the People's Court.
This is the plaintiff, the president of the United States. He claims that some phony judges are being very mean to him. He's asking for broad, unchecked power. These are the defendants. They're three judges from the Ninth Circuit Court who heard the case for Trump's travel ban and said, not in our house.
I signed a tremendous travel ban. I didn't read it, but I signed it. People took pictures of me holding up the paper, very official.
Your Honor, it was our conclusion that the ban violated the Establishment Clause because it included a religious test.
Wrong. Overruled.
I hear you want to bring in a character witness.
That's right. Someone who's known me for years. He's family. He's an incredible person with impeccable credentials, Mr. Vladimir Putin.
This is Russian President Vladimir Putin. He's an authoritarian leader who has invaded other countries and killed rivals. He's President Trump's longtime crush.
Come on, lay off President Trump, okay? This man is a great friend. He's my little American Happy Meal.
That's from last night's Saturday Night Live. Well, earlier this week, the president convened a meeting with a local law enforcement, and in the meeting, he spoke with a local sheriff in Texas, and that sheriff told the president that he didn't like a law that was being proposed in the Texas legislature.
State senator in Texas, it was talking about introducing legislation to require conviction before we could receive that forfeiture money.
Can you believe that?
And I told him that the cartel would build a monument to him in Mexico if he could get that legislation.
Who's the state senator? Do you want to give his name? We'll destroy his career.
So then there was the president's visit to military leaders and NATO coalition partners, in which he told them that the media doesn't want to report on terrorism.
The challenges facing our nation, nevertheless, are very large, very, very large. We're up against an enemy that celebrates death and totally worships destruction. You've seen that. ISIS is on a campaign of genocide, committing atrocities across the world. Radical Islamic terrorists are determined to strike our homeland, as they did on 9/11, as they did from Boston to Orlando to San Bernardino. And all across Europe, you've seen what happened in Paris and Nice. All over Europe, it's happening. It's gotten to a point where it's not even being reported. And in many cases, the very, very dishonest press doesn't want to report it. They have their reasons, and you understand that.
Although the president failed to elaborate on what those reasons might be, or the fact that a list that the White House put out of various terrorist attacks included many that were extensively reported by the media. Well, let's go back to last Sunday, where Fox News' Bill O'Reilly had an exclusive interview with Trump where he asked the president about his relationship with Russian President Vladimir Putin.
Do you respect Putin?
I do respect him.
Do you? Why?
Well, I respect a lot of people, but that doesn't mean I'm going to get along with him. He's a leader of his country.
I say it's better to get along with Russia than not. And if Russia helps us in the fight against ISIS, which is a major fight, and Islamic terrorism all over the world,
right?
Major fight, that's a good thing. Will I get along with him? I have no idea.
He's a killer, though. Putin's a killer.
A lot of killers. We got a lot of killers. Why, you think our country's so innocent? You think our country's so innocent?
I don't know of any government leaders that are killers in America.
Well, take a look at what we've done, too. We've made a lot of mistakes. I've been against the war in Iraq from the beginning.
Yeah, mistakes are different then.
A lot of mistakes, okay, but a lot of people were killed. So a lot of killers around, believe me.
That was the president's remarks to Bill O'Reilly last Sunday. Now, those remarks trying to create a moral equivalency between Putin's Russia and the United States, well, that rankled U.S. Senator John McCain, who took to the Senate floor to discuss Putin's opponent, opposition leader in Russia, Vladimir Kara-Murza. Kara-Murza is believed to have been poisoned not once, but twice.
In short, Vladimir knew that Putin is a killer, and he's a killer, and he might very well be the next target. Vladimir knew that there was no moral equivalence between the United States and Putin's Russia. I repeat, there is no moral equivalent between that butcher and thug and KGB colonel and the United States of America, the country that Ronald Reagan used to call a shining city on a hill. And to allege some kind of moral equivalence between the two is either terribly misinformed or incredibly biased. Neither can be accurate in any way.
That's Senator John McCain's denunciation of the president's attempt to create a moral equivalency between Russia and the United States. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN. Up ahead on The Sunday Spin, we'll be speaking to Elliot Richardson, co-founder and CEO of the Small Business Advocacy Council.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's The Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Good Sunday morning. I'm Rick Pearson, the Chicago Tribune, here in the Allstate Showcase Studio in Tribune Tower on Michigan Avenue. And kind of comfortable out there February. And if you think this is comfortable, wait till next weekend. We're supposed to be getting temperatures near or at 60 degrees next weekend. A little bit of a chill in the middle of the week, but then great temperatures in store. Well, before the news break, I played a cut of John McCain criticizing some of the statements the president had made regarding Vladimir Putin and trying to create a moral equivalency between Putin's Russia and the United States. McCain also came under fire from the White House over his belief that an attempt to capture or kill a leading figure in al-Qaeda in Yemen, an incident which killed an Illinois soldier, was a military failure. Here's McCain, followed by spokesman Sean Spicer.
When you lose a $75 million airplane, and more importantly, American lives are life is lost and wounded, I don't believe that you can call it a success.
It's absolutely a success. And I think anyone who would suggest it's not a success does disservice to the life of Chief Ryan Owens. He fought knowing what was at stake in that mission. And anybody who would suggest otherwise doesn't fully appreciate how successful that mission was. I think anybody who undermines the success of that raid owes an apology and a disservice to the life of Chief Owens.
Is that your message to Senator John McCain?
That's my message to anybody who says that. Anybody. I don't know how much clearer I can be.
Many years ago, when I was in prison in North Vietnam, there was an attempt to rescue the POWs. Unfortunately, the prison had been evacuated, but the brave men who partook on that mission and risked their lives in an effort to rescue us prisoners of war were genuine American heroes. Because the mission failed, did not in any way diminish their bravery and courage and a willingness to sacrifice for their fellow Americans who were being held captive. Mr. Spicer should know that story.
That's U.S. Senator John McCain. Well, joining me now here in the Allstate Showcase studio is a good friend of the program, Elliot Richardson. He's co-founder and CEO of the Small Business Advocacy Council. good morning.
Thank you, Rick. Thank you for having me.
And thanks for coming in. We've talked in the past about really the traumatic effects that the state budget impasse is having on small businesses. And over the last couple of weeks, I've had the head of the State Chamber of Commerce. I have had Greg Bays from the Illinois Manufacturers Association. And I'm kind of curious because we're seeing with the legislature coming into session again this week, and we have the governor's budget message is to be delivered on Wednesday, even though we still haven't had a full year state budget in 18-19 months. But we are seeing kind of a little bit of movement in the state Senate trying to bridge what they call a grand compromise, although that seems a lot of fits and starts going on with that. But, Elliot, you led this kind of coalition letter to the governor and the four legislative leaders, representing also the attitudes of a number of local chambers of commerce, some from neighborhoods in Chicago, some from suburbs, as well as other business groups, really just saying this can't continue.
Yeah, absolutely. And the budget impasse is not an esoteric exercise for the small business owner. And you hear a lot of people talk about this in political terms. You hear a lot of people talk about the budget impasse as a fight between the governor and Speaker Madigan. What it is devastating for the small business owner that isn't being paid by the government right now. I mean, months and months of past due bills. What is a small business owner supposed to do if they're not paid? And when they have to lay somebody off, what happens to that person because the state cannot come up with a responsible budget? And our politicians just can't work together, and that is the problem. That's a huge problem. And this budget impasse has been devastating for a lot of people.
This is a way of the state basically borrowing against these small businesses that, you know, they can't afford this.
No, a small business owner can't afford to not get paid. And, you know, the budget impasse has been devastating for for so many people, for nonprofits, for at-risk folks, but for the small business community. And I listen to your show and I hear people talk about small business as the backbone of the economy and the engine that drives the Illinois economy. So it's just stunning to think that a budget impasse could go on this long and hurt this many business owners and hurt this many people who are employed by those business owners, and you still get the political nonsense that's going on right now. What's going on in the Senate is optimistic, and we don't know how that's going to play out. But, you know, it is time to end this thing. It's time for our political leaders to come together because there are real casualties out there right now.
Well, when I had Todd Meisch from the head of the state chamber on, and the state chamber taking a look at this, and it's a still evolving kind of package before the state senate, but their view it was that they opposed the whole thing.
And I think the view of a lot of small business owners is come up with something and then let us either oppose it, support it, but do something. So, you know, unfortunately, most folks who run a small business and the people that work for them are not able to sit on political blogs all day long and follow what's coming into the packages, what's coming out of the packages. And of course, we're talking about the 13 bills that are supposed to be this grand bargain that will ultimately move the state towards having a budget and getting things working again. What we want to see, what business owners, what local businesses want to see, is our politicians do their jobs, sit down in a room, wherever they get together, and come up with a package. And there may be some good. There may be some bad in that. There will be. There'll be things that people like and don't like.
There has to be.
There has to be.
It's a compromise. There has to be something. There are no complete winners and no complete losers in this.
Rick, you said that perfectly because it's a compromise. And when you compromise, most people come out of the room somewhat happy and relatively unhappy, but then the ball moves forward. This political standoff is not only costing jobs, forcing some small businesses to frankly consider going out of business, it's also just decimating the feeling that people have that Illinois is a decent place to run a business. How could you think that way right now after watching a state that is almost non-functional for the past 18-19 months?
Well, you look at the impact on small business. You look at the fact that the state has a backlog of bills that's $11 billion.
Unbelievable.
KMOV TV in St. Louis had a piece about a woman whose son, his newborn son, his lungs hadn't fully developed, is on oxygen. The supplier of the oxygen machine came to the door and said, with a local sheriff, and said, bills haven't been paid. We have to take the machine. Now, I mean, they didn't, but that's how ridiculous this whole thing is getting.
Right. So you hear that, and then you see some of the political ads that are being run, and you say these folks in Springfield have to be completely tone deaf. I mean, completely tone deaf, because you see, and I read about that story too. I mean, you see about what was going through that mother's head when those folks came to get the oxygen machine. We get calls now from business owners that say the state owes us over $50,000. We don't know what we're going to do. What's going through that business owner's head? What's in their mind when they go home on Friday and they don't know whether or not they're going to be able to make payroll the next week? Because there's so much gamesmanship going on in Springfield, and it's tough. And there's legislators that we talk to from both sides of the aisle, and they want to get something done. But it seems like this massive battle going on the leadership level that is just really destroying everything underneath it. And we're hearing more and more of these stories of people really considering whether or not they can do business in this state if they're not getting paid, and if their customers as well, you know, aren't able to pay them. So let's say you're a small business and you do work with a nonprofit, and that's one of your big customers, and that nonprofit isn't getting paid by the state. It's all interrelated, because those nonprofits don't have money trees. They got to get paid if they're going to pay their vendors. It's all interrelated. It's all bad what's going on, and they need to solve this issue.
Is there, I mean, I have to imagine their businesses just, I will not do business with the state of Illinois.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And that's been the case for a long time, as Illinois has really...
even when we had budgets, there was always kind of the delayed payment kind of thing. It's a form of borrowing, but it puts the onus on the business that provides the service.
The nice thing about doing business with the state was always supposed to be, you might not get paid immediately, but it's the state. You're going to get paid, right? Now, I mean, that was the feeling, the security of doing business with an entity that wasn't going to go bankrupt.
That was the trade-off.
That was the trade-off. Now, people don't even have that security. So why would you be somebody that did business with one of the departments in the state of Illinois if you're really not sure when you're going to get paid at all, and then how you're going to pay your employees for that? And that's part of the big issue right now that is facing small businesses.
We're speaking with Elliot Richardson. He is the co-founder and CEO of the Small Business Advocacy Council. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Showcase studio, and joining me here is Elliot Richardson, CEO and co-founder of the Small Business Advocacy Council. We're talking about the continued impact on small businesses over the lack of a full-year state budget. Governor Rauner to deliver his budget message on Wednesday. And from what he has told us when he came to visit the Chicago Tribune editorial board, it sounds like it's going to be a rerun of a year ago when he proposed, either you all in the legislature help me make cuts and find revenue, or I'll make the cuts by myself. And that went nowhere. So, Elliot, when you were here previously, you talked about this effort to kind of try to build coalitions here to go to the legislature, to go to the leaders. And that's what you've accomplished in this letter that you've sent. What's the next step here?
Well, first, you know, a lot of local business organizations and business groups care deeply about their members. And I think they're hearing from their membership, that people who are members of different chambers are beginning to get hurt by this budget impasse. And, you know, I just applaud all of these folks for getting involved and coming on to a letter. So we don't really believe that leadership right now is motivated or is determined to bring this thing to a close. And I believe the next step will be to really start a grassroots campaign where SBAC members, where members of local chambers, where just people who are concerned really reach out to their legislators, the rank and file folks who I think want to get a budget passed, who I think want to make some good reforms to Illinois and to get money flowing again to their social service organizations and whatnot, and push them in a very respectful way to push their leadership to end this budget impasse or to come up with proposals on their own. There are remarkably intelligent legislators.
Well, you know, I've talked to rank and file. You've talked to rank and file. And you can sense their frustration. This isn't what they signed up for. And they're getting calls. And they can't do anything. Their hands are tied by whatever leadership is deciding.
They're remarkably frustrated. And unfortunately, bucking leadership right now in Springfield can have really tough results for legislators that do that. And we saw that in the last election. You know, that's one of the problems, too. Springfield seems like it is always in an election season. I mean, with all of the pain that's being inflicted on lots of folks in the state of Illinois right now, if you're unlucky enough to be on an email list and get some of these ridiculous political ads from both parties right now, you think these folks are incredibly tone deaf. I mean, they need to be focusing that energy on ending the budget impasse. So we're trying to engage as many business organizations, as many civic organizations as possible, and say we will do anything we can to help you, help your rank and file legislators put this budget impasse to a close. And it might take a revolt from rank and file legislators against party leadership to actually get this done. And they're going to have to hear from a lot of people. And we're going to have to get engaged. The onus is on us. It's hard. We're running businesses. We're running our lives. We're not the folks who went to Springfield. But we're going to have to put that sort of pressure on rank and file legislators, I believe, to get this budget impasse accomplished. Ended.
Well, do you think among the leadership, that includes the governor, that they want to get something done? Or is this just the prelims for 2018?
It's a tough question, and we're not in their heads. And that's the problem. What I see is proposals that have been put out there that the governor and the Democratic leadership and the Republican leadership should embrace. There is proposals for workers' comp that make remarkable sense, common sense, the law in over half the states, like proportional causation, that really should be accepted by just about everybody, term limits for leadership. I have not heard one member of our organization, whether Democratic or Republican, say that's a bad idea. Government consolidation. The ideas are out there. Constitutional pension reform. Come on. We need constitutional pension reform. We've needed it for such a long time. And there's proposals that are out there. So when you don't see the leaders grasp those and try to put something together and get into a room and try to work it out, you know, I'm not confident that they want to put an end to it. And I think the fact that we're celebrating that the Senate leaders from both parties are talking to one another is relatively pathetic. I mean, these folks should be talking all the time. They're trying to govern a state. So I think we'll see over the next 2 weeks who really wants to try to end this budget impasse after almost 2 years. And it's going to be interesting to see who steps up to the plate.
Well, one of the unique features, and we've talked about this on the program before, of this attempt at a grand bargain is that all of these bills are interconnected. And so they all have to pass.
They all have to pass. And, you know, some of your guests have talked about it. I mean, there have been some really good ideas in these bills. There have been some bad ideas in these bills. I mean, the opportunity tax was not a good idea from our members' perspective, but it's been pulled. That's my understanding.
Yes.
I mean, again, you almost need a Twitter feed, you know, every hour to see what's in these bills and what's not. But you're 100% right. They're all interconnected. But let's have our leaders work with those, have legislators work with those, and come up with something that they can present. And then folks could take a position on it. And if they're not willing to vote on something to put in front of the citizens of Illinois and the entire legislature, then individual legislators should do that themselves. And they have every opportunity to get into a room, Democrats and Republicans, and present proposals, put that out to the public, and put pressure on their leadership. And that is leadership. And that's what we're going to need from our rank and file legislators.
Well, I know on the Republican side that there was a great deal of concern among rank and file Republicans that in this package that there wasn't, they felt that there wasn't enough for business, that wasn't enough pro-business in it to then in exchange ask for new taxes.
Every Democrat and Republican that you talk to that's serious understands that there's going to need to be some sort of tax increase. And I think they'll all say it, and they've said it publicly. They can go farther on comp reform with proportional causation.
You just shorthand.
Absolutely, absolutely. So right now, there's a 1% threshold. If a employee can show that their injury was caused at work by 1%, then the employer is responsible for the entire injury. Governor Rauner said, listen, I want a 50% threshold. That's only the law in a handful of states and will never be the law in Illinois. And it's very tough. What the SBAC and other groups have said is proportional causation, like many other states do. If you're hurt at work and that's a 30% cause of your present condition, then your employer would pay 30%. So it's a compromise. It's a common ground. It makes sense. We're waiting for the Republicans or the Democrats to grasp that concept. We literally go to Springfield. We put this proposal in front of Democrats. We put this proposal in front of Republicans, and we're waiting for somebody to take the ball and run with it. So that's a type of common sense reform that would be good for business, should be something that the Democrats can at least tolerate to some extent, and would help move this grand bargain forward. And there's more things just like that.
Well, some people also have said, and I think even Comptroller Susana Mendoza last week said that the like you touched on term limits for legislative leaders. The governor wants term limits for everybody. But she said, I've never ran into somebody that ran a small business that cares about term limits as essential to their business.
Well, I would disagree with the comptroller in that respect. I mean, when the confidence in the Illinois economy is a very big deal for small business owners, whether or not they want to hire, whether they want to expand, whether or not they want to take another space, that all has to do with how they feel about the environment in which they're operating their business. And business owners do not like the fact that entrenched politicians can be there for such a long period of time that they really feel that they lose their voice. There's a lot of things that matter to small business owners. And we need politicians probably to listen a little more to us, probably stop talking so much about small business as a talking point, the political football.
You guys are like education.
Well, I mean, does a small business owner wake up in the morning and go, man, I'm looking for term limits for leadership? No. They wake up in the morning and they go, I hope whatever I do is done on time. I hope my employees have a good day and show up. I hope that we have enough money to make ends meet. But it all impacts the Illinois economy. So however it is that they could get a package done that ends the budget impasse and doesn't throw anything overboard, a common sense way to end the budget impasse, small business owners want to see this thing put to an end.
That's Elliot Richardson. He's the co-founder and CEO of the Small Business Advocacy Council. Your website?
www.sbacil.org.
Elliot, thanks so much for joining me this morning.
As always, Rick, thank you so much for having us.
We'll be back with more right after this.
Now, the Sunday Spin continues on 720 WGN.
Here's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning, and welcome to the second hour of your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Showcase studio in Tribune Tower. We've heard the president repeatedly label things he doesn't like as trying to diminish the media by calling it fake news. Well, CNN's Jake Tapper spoke with Trump advisor Kellyanne Conway last week and questioned why the president would knowingly spout falsehoods.
I'm talking about the president of the United States saying things that are not true, demonstrably not true. That is important and arguably more important than whoever reached you at your daughter's play.
Well, are they more important than the many things that he says that are true that are making a difference in people's lives? I just think we want coverage of that as well.
They distract from them. They distract from the things he says.
They do. And I think, look, I think I was handed a fact sheet that perhaps the president was referring to when he talked about that today with the sheriffs, which, by the way, was an unbelievably productive, moving listening session that I attended. But when he talks about the 47 years and the rate, I'm handed the information, I think you referred to it as well, that we have had an increase from 2014 to 2015.
Yeah, I said that.
In rapes and murders and assaults. I'm probably looking at the same data you are. And so he may have heard
it's
that
FBI,
about a particular
city. It's FBI crime reports. But it's FBI. It's to say that there was a spike in murder rates in between 2014 and 2015 is true. To say we need to bring that down and we need to have law and order, all that fine. He said it's the highest murder rate in 47 years, and the media doesn't report it. And again, Kellyanne, the media doesn't report it because it's a lie, because it's not true.
That's CNN's Jake Tapper speaking with presidential advisor Kellyanne Conway. Well, joining me now on the phone is Republican Congressman Peter Roskam from Wheaton. And Congressman Roskam on the House Ways and Means Committee and chairman of the Tax Policy Panel, you've got a big job out there coming ahead. Welcome.
Yeah, there's never a dull moment, Rick, and I think there's an incredible opportunity, and I am of the opinion that we're at a national inflection point on our tax code in particular, and I think that we are on the cusp of fundamental tax reform, which I am wholeheartedly in favor of, because this tax code that we have is essentially dissolving underneath us. It's not working anymore, and we can either sit here and sort of just avoid the inevitable, or we can say, look, we've got to change this. Let's move to a different tax code, and I hope we can do it, and I think we will.
One of the things that people have talked to me about and expressed concern are things about the mortgage interest deduction going away, and also concerns, and I think these are concerns from some of the larger local property taxing states like Illinois about the loss of that local tax deductibility aspect.
Right. Both of those things are really significant. So there's a blueprint that the House majority, the House Republicans, put out in the middle of the summer, which is meant to spur discussion. And what we've proposed on the individual tax side is to have a tax code where 95% of Americans would not itemize. They would literally fill something out on something kind of on a big postcard, essentially. In our proposal, you would keep the mortgage interest deduction, you would keep the charitable deduction, you would refashion a number of the things below the line, that is, refashion a retirement program, refashion an approach on education savings and so forth. The property tax or the state and local tax deduction is part of a negotiation right now. Red states look at it as a subsidy through the tax code of blue states, so we've got to negotiate through that. But this is all in an interest in trying to lower the rates, create growth, and I think we can get this done.
Well, I have to say your appearance on the show generated a number of questions, and I just want to go to the heart of one that's probably been the most asked is, are you planning to do a town hall meeting? We've obviously seen some of the consternation that's existed at other town halls being held, most notably by Chavez out in Salt Lake
Utah,
City.
Yeah.
But are you planning on doing any kind of a town hall public gathering appearance?
My approach has always been, the entire time I've served in Congress, I did one town hall meeting, and I didn't find it particularly productive. Town hall meetings tend to be platforms for people to shout at one another and get angry at one another and leave more upset and disappointed and bent out of shape than when people came. And the proof of that is just look at the national news. These are not productive meetings. What I've done is a different approach over the years, and I've gotten good feedback in the district. I've hosted, and I'll just give you a couple of statistics. In 2016, I had 30 different roundtable discussions, 11 telephone town hall meetings, and these are formats. The telephone town hall, for example, I'm doing one tomorrow night. I usually have 10,000 people on that call. I'll probably, based on the interest, have a much higher number than that tomorrow night. And there's an opportunity for people who don't go to town hall meetings and don't write their congressman and don't write letters to the editor, but you go into their kitchen, so to speak, and they can actively participate. And the feedback I've gotten is terrific. So in answer to your question, I have no plans to have one of these big sort of circus meetings, but instead try to hear from my district, both people who, you know, are concerned about some of the positions that I've taken, and you'll hear those tomorrow night from people who are going to let me hear their opinion, and it's counter to mine, and that's part of the democracy. But those larger meetings are just not productive.
Is there a place where people can access the phone number for
this?
Yeah,
there is, and they can go to my campaign website, roskamforcongress.com, and they can sign up for it.
Okay. That's Congressman Peter Roskam. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back with the congressman with more right after this. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Showcase studio on Tribune Tower on Michigan Avenue. Joining me on the phone is Congressman Peter Roskam, a Republican from Wheaton. Congressman, a number of email questions that I've received involve the Affordable Care Act and what is the process here. We all know about the votes to get rid of it, but what about the replacement?
Right, that's a fair point. So go back, just to take a running start, go back to when President Obama won in 2009. I would venture that we had a national consensus, regardless of whether people voted for President Obama or voted against him. There was a national consensus around two issues. Number one, that health care was too expensive and that many of the cost drivers were not making anybody any healthier. And the second thing is, it really bothered us that somebody with a pre-existing condition was locked out of an insurance pool. The better pathway, in my opinion, would have to deal with those two issues. The Obama administration went a different direction. It's their prerogative, but they went a different direction. And now we've got this, the Affordable Care Act, that is just not working. I've got any number of constituents over the years and recently that have been communicating to me, spikes in premiums, spikes in deductibles, out of network issues, and so forth. So the status quo isn't working. Okay, so now what do we do? There is the example of the passage of the Affordable Care Act is an example, in my opinion, of how not to do this. It was written in Nancy Pelosi's office as Speaker. She famously said, "We've got to pass it so that you know what's in it." And that's just not a great way to legislate. So what we're proposing is to say, okay, look, let's break this down, and let's have a much more bottom-up approach. And so there's two core things. One is identifying the cost drivers. So some of that is the lack of market availability of people to put enough money into their health savings accounts to meet their own deductibles. Some of that has to do with the ability to sell insurance across state lines. Some of that is the net effect that follows of the lockout of a dominant insurance market because they don't face any competition. Then you've also got this notion of just an employer-based system where there's no flexibility and you're locked into your coverage. So all of that is to say we're going to do it slowly and deliberately and have a smooth transition, realizing that a lot of people have come to depend on the Affordable Care Act. So the false narrative that's running is, hey, it's just going to get cut, and that's the end of the day. Now, there's a lot of interest in making sure that it's a smooth transition, because I would argue that the ACA is collapsing underneath itself. And to stay here, not unlike tax reform, by the way, to stay here is basically to wait for that to happen, have these markets collapse, and then we're really, really stuck.
What about as far as states like Illinois and others that have used the ACA and the federal funding to be able to increase coverage through Medicaid?
Right. So you've got states like Illinois, and off the top of my head, it's about 650,000 people who got on to Medicaid through the ACA, and I think another 350,000 people got on through the marketplace. So here's what you got to navigate through. States like Illinois, who under Governor Quinn expanded it greatly. States like Indiana that were, I would argue, were far more, they expanded, but they were more entrepreneurial and more interesting and just smarter about how they did it and had other cost mitigators that were put in place. And then other states across the country that said, we're not going to expand our Medicaid population. And so they declined the money. So you can see inherently the difficulty of that conflict. And I'm confident that over a period of time, we can negotiate something that's reasonable, that gives folks a good transition and a soft landing. But again, even the Medicaid side of things, has Medicaid helped some people? Yeah, it has. But it also, there's not really a great celebration in terms of dumping 650,000 people onto a Medicaid system that is just not working by and large.
Another question that we received is issues involving the president, involving President Trump, issues like, for example, the travel ban. What is your view of how that came about and what its goal is?
I think its goal is lofty. I think its implementation was incredibly clumsy. So the lofty goal is to say, look, let's recognize the nature of terror, and the terror threat has fundamentally shifted in the world in the past several years. And we've seen in France, for example, one of the terrorists was posing as a refugee. So to act as if there's not an attempt on the part of America's enemies to manipulate the refugee program is just naive. Now, the way in which the ban was drafted, the way in which it was implemented, was incredibly cumbersome and may not be constitutional. So I think that there's going to be an attempt to review and to revisit this, but just to nod along and accept the status quo, that is, of an immigration system that has not really performed too well, I think would have been a failure as well.
Although you have the fact with those seven countries that the president targeted that there really has been no act committed by anybody from those seven countries.
Yeah, but think about the inverse is true. If you had had an act, or if he had been in office and something would have happened from those seven countries, and think about what those countries are. A number of them are failed states that don't have a much of a capacity to vet on their own. Iran is obviously hostile. So there's a I don't think it's an unreasonable thing to focus in on those seven states. It gets characterized as a Muslim ban. It's obviously not a Muslim ban. But I think the larger point is implementation and follow through. So if you're caught up in that innocently, it would have been harrowing and daunting and very, very upsetting. And so this is the natural balance that we have in our country between we expect a government to protect our liberties, and we expect a government to also protect us physically. And there's natural tension there. And this was obviously a pretty cumbersome effort at that.
Also got a question regarding guns and gun legislation. A question from a listener wanting to know if you would support a concealed carry reciprocity, which would extend that across state lines and basically change the way that Illinois, for example, operates its concealed carry program.
I would have to look at that. I know that it's an area that is coming upon us. There's been legislation that's been introduced in the House of Representatives to that effect, And the devil would be in the details on that. So I haven't made up my mind. I need more input on that.
Also, questions about, you know, actually with now the revelations about General Kelly and perhaps conversations about Russian sanctions and obviously a lot of consternation about the whole issue of the president and whatever ties may exist between him and the Russians. What about as far as having House oversight look into this?
I think Russian sanctions and the continuation of Russian sanctions are incredibly important. It would be a strategic mistake to undo them. And if we did, then Europe would follow. Putin would be Putin would gain an incredible advantage. The violence in the eastern part of Ukraine, in the Donbas region and Luhansk, would be exacerbated, and it would be essentially a frozen conflict, and Russia would prevail, and Ukraine would essentially be broken in their interest in moving into the West. So the Constitution, as we know, gives an incredible amount of authority to the executive branch. This was part of my frustration during the Obama administration on the Iran deal and the sale, you know, the proposed sale of Boeing airplanes and so forth. And so there is a role for the House to play in terms of bringing attention to these things. And I think that the House needs to be a platform to raise the discussion, particularly as it relates to Ukrainian aggression.
And finally, I just want an overall assessment. You know, obviously, we're only 3 weeks into this presidency, but it's been, you know, a lot has happened and a lot of discussion and a lot of concerns. And, you know, I even started out this segment with Jake Tapper kind of venting about the fake news aspect of things when the president knowingly tells falsehoods. And there just seems to be, you know, we all understand in politics there's such things as spin and, you know, to try to put the best face on things. But there is also the fact that you do have a president who knowingly says things that are false. And that seems very concerning when this is the person who is representing our country.
My opinion is the American public elected a provocateur. They elected somebody to provoke Washington, to provoke basically everybody, and Donald Trump is doing that. On the positive end of things, I look at a number of his choices in terms of the Supreme Court, cabinet positions, some of these people I know personally, and I have a high regard for them. His style is obviously provocative. It worked for him. It worked in the course of a primary that nobody thought he would win. It worked in the course of a general election that nobody thought he would win. So clearly he's onto a formula that is effective. And I think he's basically flipping the game board of American politics. So he's not the first person that said things erroneously. Remember, President Obama said, "If you like your coverage, you get to keep it."
How did I know you were going to bring that one?
Well, it's like it's right there. So, you know, all those sorts of things. I think the American public. I'm not defending anything that's said that's false or misstatements, whether knowing or unknowing. But that said, I think that there is a calibration all the way around. The American public has learned to discount things. They've learned to discount, you know, for example, not much coverage of the March for Life in Washington, D.C. And there's thousands of people that come out, or I'm downtown Chicago with three other members of Congress giving a talk on the pro-life movement and pretty de minimis coverage. So there's an ebb and flow to this. And I think most people, Rick, in my opinion, their eyes kind of glaze over and they're fairly dismissive of sort of the showboating and the spin. And the bottom line is, hey, what are you doing to make my life better? What are you doing on my taxes? What is really going to happen on health care? What's going to happen in terms of regulations and so forth? And I think that is, there's an opportunity and there's also obstacles as everybody is trying to navigate through pretty much a new political scene all the way around.
That's Congressman Peter Roskam, Republican from Wheaton. Congressman, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Thanks, Rick. Thanks for having me on.
We'll be back with more right after this. Up ahead on the Sunday Spin, we'll be speaking with Michael Golden, the author of Unlock Congress and senior fellow at the Adlai Stevenson Center on Democracy.
This is the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN. Once again, here's Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune.
Good Sunday morning. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Showcase studio. And joining me here in studio is my good friend Michael Golden, author of Unlock Congress, a recent birthday boy. Thanks for being able to show up here this morning. Appreciate it very much. Michael, you heard Congressman Roskam in the previous segment. We were talking, you know, probably one of the foremost concerns is the issue of where goest the Affordable Care Act, a.k.a. Obamacare. And, you know, with all of the Republican efforts to repeal as a minority or even in a majority, but with a Democratic president. And now it's repeal it, but what comes next? And I think that's really driving some of the consternation along with, besides the concerns over the president. But where do you see this debate going on what the future of the Affordable Care Act is?
Well, first of all, thanks for having me. There's nowhere I'd rather be hungover than in the Allstate WGN Showcase Studio.
I think you were the first guest I've ever had to admit that.
Yeah, well, you know, truth, no fake news, truth. So actually, this is a really interesting question to me beyond the parameters you just laid out, because it does tie in to what you know I wrote about in Unlock Congress, and healthcare was one of the examples I used. We've known for decades and decades and decades that this is a system that needed to be fixed. I call it a non-system because it wasn't. Right, the parts weren't working together. It cost a fortune. There wasn't enough access. And what President Obama tried to do, you know, if he had his choice, he probably would have single payer or public option. But you can't, you know, you certainly can't do that in Washington right now because of that logjam. So what did they do? They compromised. A lot of people on the right would think that's not compromise, but it is. It's based on conservative plans going back, 10 years. And the thing is that even with all the good it did, 20 million new insured, and the cost curves looks to be bending down at least a little long term, and that's a lot of what this is about, our long-term unfunded liabilities where the country's going bankrupt. You have to change that. You have to have preventative care, so on and so forth, pre-existing conditions. Everybody knows the good stuff. And with the Republicans, I remember when I first heard those words, repeal and replace, you know, I thought, well, that's just a great marketing term. It's alliterative, R-E-L-P, you know, it just sounds, they'll be riding that thing for years. And they did. The problem is, that's a locked-in position. That's not, you know, and now, it's not, they probably knew this, but they wanted to win elections. And that's, you know, part of what I have problems with is that these guys, Congress doesn't work together to fix problems the way they used to, especially for big pieces of legislation that need it. Social Security was fixed. Medicare has been fixed time and time again. But nowadays, look, the last time we had an immigration, comprehensive immigration bill fixed, or even tried to be fixed, was Simpson-Mazzoli 30 years ago. So these things sit out there. And where is this going? It's going to be difficult to tell, because what would be great is if the parties came together and said, okay, we know we have these problems with the hours worked and some of the cost problems and that, you know, the insurance, some of the companies have dropped out and there's not as much choice. We agree it's not perfect. As Democrats, we agree it's not perfect. But don't let the bottom drop out of this whole thing and rattle markets and risk doing things that I don't even think the Republicans want to do. And you can hear them now talking about, well, it's going to take longer, and that's fine. But it would be great to see the parties actually work together. As you know, the problem is, especially in the House, they're already looking down the barrel of elections. In 3 weeks into a new administration, they're looking at 2018, which is why I'm for four-year terms, by the way.
Well, and you do hear things like the things that everybody can agree on from the Affordable Care Act. As you said, the coverage for pre-existing conditions. I think everybody agrees about having your child on your parents' coverage till they're 26. That's almost become like a universal acceptance of that. But then you start dealing into issues of private market and all of those things. And plus the true affecting the economy of what healthcare spending is as a part of the U.S. economic product.
Yeah, and not to get too super nerdy, but there is an interesting philosophical derivative of why there are these problems in the healthcare non-system. And that is that, unlike a lot of other countries, the word regulation in America has become a dirty word. And really, though, that goes back to our founding, you know, that original idea of free market, no monarchy, we just want a war, we want to be able to do this in the state, so on and so forth. And that's why more so progressives want the power of the central government to make things fair for most people, and a lot of conservatives would rather have the states handle it. And you can have an argument as to which is better. But when it comes to health care, right, there's an inherent conflict in our government trying to provide health care within an industry that's a for-profit industry, that it's always going to be difficult unless you provide health care for all your people, which is what single payer is. If you're going to have these markets and have insurance, people call it the health care reform. It was health insurance reform. We didn't reform that much of how all the health care is delivered, but at least more people were covered and they tried to change the costs a bit. So this is tricky stuff. I don't pretend to have all the answers, and that's why I go back to the point. A problem that's this complicated, you got to get people in a room that can listen to each other and agree on a set of facts. And you hear that same stale argument going back and forth. You know, you had even Congressman Roskam was talking about if you like your doctor, you can keep it. Yes, that was wrong. That's not the same as the lies we're hearing now. That was incorrect. You can make an argument even that the administration may have believed that and made a miscalculation. So it would be great if the parties could actually sit down and talk about those stuff, even have public hearings to the point where it could educate Americans. And I think President Obama was going to try to do that, and then they kind of scrapped that. Remember, right. They were going to have full transparency. And like we're seeing play out with the court stuff, it would have been a good civics lesson for the few people like us who would have watched it.
Well, you also touched on immigration, for example. And, of course, you know, here we are with we have the Ninth Circuit's ruling.
Yeah.
We had last night's SNL with the People's Court ruling.
But I did see that before I nodded off, yeah.
The Congressman Roskam says he thinks there's a laudable goal here in this travel ban. I'd like your thoughts on this.
You know, I have a different take on this. There's so much controversy over it being called a Muslim ban, and I think Congressman Roskam just said that it's not a Muslim ban, or it's based on these other seven countries. And just because it's their majority Muslim countries doesn't mean it's a Muslim ban. I'm not even going to get into that because I think there's a lot. And this is really an opinion. I'm basing it on things I've heard and read, especially read about Steve Bannon. And I think that where these guys really bonded, Trump and Bannon, is that Trump was screaming these populist screeds during the primaries and the general election about illegal immigration, about the forgotten man, about, you know, unemployment and ripping and not giving any credit for the economic recovery that we have seen even in measured fashion over the last years. And if you read about Steve Bannon and in his own quotes, and you don't know this is true or not, but when, you know, he describes himself not as a white nationalist, not as a nationalist, but as an economic nationalist. And he describes what that means. And I think that this was them dipping their toe in the water to just stop immigration, legal immigration. I think that those swing states that Donald Trump won and brought people into Congress, believe shockingly, on his own coattails when everyone thought the reverse was going to be true, I think that with the problems we have in this country and the Rust Belt and factories gone and a changing economy, I think that what they want to do is tighten the borders, period. I think that, you know, Steve Bannon said something along the lines of, I'm paraphrasing, but let us do this our way, and we'll have control for 50 years. And he was talking, he said we'll get X percent of the black vote, X percent of the Latino vote, like he had sort of mapped this out, not in a way that we don't need the minority vote, just that we're going to take care of the people here. And so I think that this was a way of doing that was aligned with Trump's anti, well, anti-everything, right? and it hasn't gone that well. If you're trying to tip your toe in the water and take that first step towards really cutting off more immigration, you do it so sloppily like this. I'm not sure how well it bodes for just try. You know, I think it's a numbers game. They want to keep the population where it is and try to increase job growth through whatever plans they come out with. But I think that that's hidden in this whole big controversy about it being a Muslim land. Now, I'm against it anyway, but what I think might be the deeper meaning.
Look over here instead of looking over there.
Exactly.
We're speaking with Michael Golden. He's the author of Unlock Congress, and he's a senior fellow at the Edley Stevenson Center on Democracy. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin on this beautiful Sunday morning in downtown Chicago. The sun is starting to make its way through the clouds, and we're supposed to have a sunny afternoon, but windy today. We're speaking here in the Allstate Showcase studio with my good friend Michael Golden. He's the author of Unlock Congress and was recently named a senior fellow at the Edley Stevenson Center on Democracy. And I know that they are putting together this democracy reform agenda. Why don't you tell us what that's all about?
Well, this has been a real honor, you know, being a native Illinoisan and this legendary political family, former Senator Stephen Stevenson III. He's a fascinating...
Add three,
exactly. And his father was the Gov, affectionately known as the Gov, who ran for president twice in the 50s. And the former senator... who came to my 50th last night. We've become fast friends. And, you know, he's 86 years old, nearly, and he's got this idea that's aligned with a lot of the things that I wrote about in Unlock Congress. And we met last year, and then he read my book and reached out to me and asked for, I was shocked and honored, you know, help on the congressional forums. And it's this agenda for political reform that the center, a nonpartisan Stevenson Center, is promoting. And we're still putting it together and bringing in stakeholders so we get a lot of opinions outside of what we think. And it's pretty broad. It's not just about Congress. Although it's about campaign finance reform, it is about unrigging districts. It's about the Electoral College is a piece of this. There might even be a piece on civic education because you know that's where it starts, is informing folks about this stuff. And we're going to bring in stakeholders like Common Cause, like Mayday.us, you know, a number of reformers that are working on some of these issues. And the point is, and you know this is a passion of mine, that no matter what side of the aisle you're on, we need to change some rules here in order to get this system functioning again. And boy, do we need that in Illinois. This is not just an agenda for reform for federal offices. Some of the questions were asked, can we streamline some of the offices here? Voting rights, that's no matter where you are and what reforms you're choosing, we got midterms coming up in 2018, and voting rights and voting abuses and voting suppression is a huge issue. I don't mean the ridiculous claims of this president about 3 million votes. I mean efforts using that cynical accusation to try to suppress the vote in places where it could be advantageous to one side of the aisle. So it's a real honor working on this with Senator Stevenson. He's the former Illinois treasurer, former U.S. senator. He was a U.S. Marine. He served in Korea. A fascinating life. And a little quick footnote that I didn't know till this past year. His great-great-grandfather is the one who convinced Abraham Lincoln to run for president.
I thought that was the Chicago Tribune.
Well, it's Mr. Fell. I'm forgetting his first name. But, he came on my podcast program a week ago, Adelaide III, and just listening to his stories and this fountain of wisdom and experience on these issues, because he's seen it all. And when he was in the U.S. Senate for 12 years, I believe 70 to 82, he was a big reformer. And that's when you remember the Jake Javits, that's when there were more representatives and senators who talked to each other, and you had liberal Republicans, and you had, you know, Reagan Democrats, and you had more of a mix until this regional realignment we've seen over the last couple decades that's kind of split our country into the red and blue more so.
Well, and more division, more winner take all, more nonstop campaign. And I used to, as I've said many times, I used to joke that I never really wanted to cover D.C. because I could go back to Springfield because Springfield in its day actually functioned.
It did. And we talk about that, especially when they had cumulative voting and proportional representation before they changed the number in the assembly.
The Pat Quinn cutback amendment.
Right, that's right.
That invested more power into the leadership. And now at a time with where money is the king, it's the people with the money that control the votes.
That's right. And that's number one. I mean, like I said, it's a work in progress, but number one on that list is campaign finance reform. It's and the best, look, we've known for decades that something smelled wrong with the system, but now there's empirical data. And one of the most impactful statistics in the presentation I do about Unlock Congress is the study by Martin Gillens and Ben Page of Princeton Northwestern. They took 1,779, so nearly 2,000 policy questions, and statistically ran how they were decided in Congress over many years. And what they found was the top 10% wealthiest in this country, their preferences have 15 times the influence on government decisions as the rest of us, 90%. So, and basically, I'm quoting them, they said the majority does not rule in this country.
The numbers game.
Yeah.
That's Michael Golden. He's the author of Unlock Congress and a senior fellow, the new senior fellow, at the Edley Stevenson Center on Democracy. Michael, happy birthday and thanks for joining me.
It's great to be 30 years old, Rick. Thanks for having me, guys.
We'll be back with more right after this. That's all we have time for on this week's edition of the Sunday Spin. I want to thank all of my guests. Elliot Richardson, the founder and co-founder and CEO of the Small Business Advocacy Council. Congressman Peter Roskam, a Republican congressman from Wheaton. And Michael Golden, the author of Unlock Congress and senior fellow at the Adlai Stevenson Center on Democracy. Most of all, I want to thank all of you for listening. It's been a great morning. And thanks for all of your text messages and other messages, especially those for the congressman. And now it's time to turn things over to the great Dean Richards.
Did you get my text message?
I got yours, too, yes.
I got yours, all right. That's for sure.
I got it right here.
Hey, wait a minute. Big night tonight. The Grammy Awards
are
tonight. Music industry's biggest night. Beyonce is nominated for 9 awards tonight. She is the most nominated female artist of all time. She's got 62 nominations total.
Wow.
If she wins 8 of the awards for which she's nominated tonight, she will become the most awarded artist in the history of recorded sound.
That's amazing.
Right?
That is just amazing.
But Adele is also up for plenty of awards tonight, too. It's going to be a battle, I think, between those two tonight for...
The
awards. We're going to preview the artists. It's one of my favorite mornings. Outside of the morning when they announce what artists are appearing at Lollapalooza, and I feel like the oldest person in the world.
Which you refer to on air, even.
Go to Uncle Dean. Today, when I feature some of the Grammy-nominated songs and artists, another of the mornings where I go, that's not music. I don't know what you're talking about. So we'll...
you'll help educate all of us.
We will. It'll be music education here this morning. If there's anything you think about my show, it's educational.